My name is Joel Bell, and I am been a member here at Christ Pres since 2010 when my wife Jill and I moved here with our three kiddos, and I'm a deacon here. My day job is a financial advisor. I have a firm and have worked with a lot of different folks over the years in various aspects of retirement planning, and that's kind of the focus of what we're going to talk about today. If you haven't been here in a couple weeks, or maybe even just new to this series, we are doing a series called Held in Trust. We are in week five, and we're talking about the future you is counting on the present you. So basically we're going to be talking about some retirement basics. Some of this may be fairly elementary. We're all at different phases of life, some of us in this room. Are probably either near retirement or are retired, and others may just be getting started. And this is a little bit of a follow-up to John Adrian's last week, which was the emergency that wasn't. So that was, there's somewhat of a hierarchy of when it comes to saving and investing, you want to cover your bases. And the first thing you want to do is make sure you've got an emergency fund and have savings set aside for things that come up that oftentimes people aren't planned for. So John covered that last week. But today, again, we're talking more about the future and things you can be doing today to help take care of that. So we'll start with a Bible verse from Proverbs, which is full of lots of good sayings and axioms about financial stewarding. And you probably have all heard of the proverb of the ant, but it says, go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a robber and want like an armed man. So I think that's a good reminder. Just something as simple as an ant and how diligent they are in terms of preparing for the future. But preparation isn't fear. It's really a form of wisdom. There's lots of examples in the Bible about biblical wisdom for planning. I think John may have referenced a couple of these last week, but again, Proverbs has lots of different verses on this topic. But one of which is from Proverbs 21:5 that says, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance. Another proverb is from 13:22, a good person leaves an inheritance to children's children. I've always wondered what that says about your own children when sometimes people, I guess for those that are grandparents in the room, maybe can understand that a little bit better in terms of wanting to take care of their grandchildren. I don't think it necessarily means you want to skip your children, lest you create some discontent one day in your wills and things of that nature. But Luke 14:28, Jesus is talking about telling a parable, but he goes on to say basically who would build a tower, I think it is. It's referenced before first counting what the cost of the tower to be to build would cost. Matthew 25, there's a couple examples about faithful stewardship. There's the parable of the 10 virgins, five of which who are prepared and go out with oil for their lanterns. The other five are not. And that's also there's a reference of the parable of the 10 talents that we'll talk a little bit about. And then Genesis 41, I think John mentioned this last week, but Joseph planning for the 7 years of famine certainly was a form of biblical stewardship as well. One day you will become this person. Some of you may be closer to that person than others in this room, but the decisions that you make and the habits that you form will shape that person's life. We'll talk a little bit about time and the importance of time and the importance of saving and investing early, but if you could sit down with yourself 30 years from now, maybe what would be that advice that you would give your current self? What would you do differently, or what would you beg your present self to do? best time to plant a tree. It was 20 years ago. Don't know who said that, but that's often been said and circulated over the years. The second best time is to plant it today. And that's I think an analogy for compound interest. Many people have heard that I think Einstein has been credited with it, although when I researched this, I don't think there was any evidence that he said it, but compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. I think probably many people have heard that saying before. The second part of that saying, I think it's just as important, he who understands it earns it, he who doesn't pays it. There's a section coming up, I think, I can't remember who's teaching it, but there's a class is being taught on debt, and obviously, there's good debt and there's bad debt, but compound interest can work for you. John alluded to that a little bit last week about mortgages and how those things can, over time, make the importance of making your payments, and you start to see gradual improvement of more principal payments versus interest payments. But compound interest can either work for you or against you. This is just a brief little slide that we'll talk a little bit about, and we'll kind of pivot a little bit from, more biblical wisdom. But one of the tools and resources that most of us have available to access are investments in the stock market. And this is a piece that comes from J.P. Morgan, and it shows the range of stocks and bonds over the last 75 years. The green bar is represented by the stock market, as measured by the S&P 500. Blue is measured as measuring bonds and their performance, and then the gray, darker color on the right is the as a 60-40 portfolio of 60% stocks and 40% bonds. So this gives you some ideas as to what you can expect from investing. So many of you that are working probably have access to a retirement plan. If you don't, you can set one up yourself at places like Vanguard and Fidelity. But the green, you can see those returns on the far left over a one-year period can be highly volatile. The best return for the stock market going back to 1950 is 52%. Who wouldn't sign up for that? However, there would be no upside potential if there was no downside risk, and that's where that minus 37% comes from. If you go out further over 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years, you can see those bands become much more compressed. So the worst 20-year period for the stock market had a 6% return over a 20-year period. The best 20-year period had an 18% return. And a more modest blended portfolio might have that far right gray, that 5 and 15, shows that over a 20-year period, the worst return you would have had would have been about 5%. The best return would have been about 15% per year. And you can see in the very top, that little box, that shows $100,000 invested over 20 years would grow to, on average, about $908,000 in the stock market, and bonds about $277,000, and then in a blended 60-40 portfolio, about $606,000. So I say all that to say, when we talk about compound interest and what's realistic, you often hear that the stock market averages 10% per year, and that's about what this is showing. Over the last 75 years, it's averaged about 11.7% per year. Or a more modest portfolio, about 9.4%. So this is, especially for the young people in this room, if you don't remember anything else, just remember that this is probably the most important slide when it comes to having time on your side. We've all, if you think back to our school days, seeing compound interest charts, and the exponential growth is on the back end, that 30, 40 year window of having your money work for you over all those years. But $300 invested per month, which is not an insignificant amount of money, but $300 invested per month at a 9% average return. So again, we're just using a historical return over the last 75 years for a 60% stock, 40% bond portfolio. We're not using 11.7 or 12%, but just an average 9% return from age 25 to 65 would grow to $1.4 million. So again, $300 a month, especially when you're 25, that can be a lot of money, but it could also be the difference between a brand new car and maybe a car that's 5 or 7 years old that has a smaller monthly payment, and the difference could be invested. So it certainly shouldn't be out of the grasp of anybody to potentially save that much if they're diligent in prioritizing and budgeting. That same person who waits till 45, maybe they want to drive that nicer car, or they want to get that nicer house, or travel, or do some of the things because you're only young once, and you wait 20 years to start saving. Now all of a sudden you save that same $300 per month, but instead of having 40 years of working for you, you have only 20 years to work that money to work for you, and that would only grow to $200,000. So that 20-year delay in savings wind up costing you $1.2 million, and it's really, you know, that 20 years you saved what, $3,600 for 20 years. That's $72,000 you saved, but it grew to $1.2 million. So that's certainly a big gap and a big number. And again, if you're younger in this room, that's a very important takeaway to get your money working for you. The sooner, the better. This is a good verse from 2 Corinthians 12:14. It says, "For children are not obligated to save up for their parents, but parents for their children." So, you know, Paul is talking to the Corinthian church, and he's basically saying he doesn't want to be a burden. He doesn't want their money. He wants them to be able to provide for their children and for their neighbors and others in the church. But ultimately, good financial stewardship includes the future, not just the present. And planning for retirement is one of the most important things. I think my slide got cut off there, but planning for retirement is one of the best gifts that we can give our children so that we don't become a burden on them one day. I've seen that in real life a lot of times. It's kind of my generation, people in their 40s and 50s that have their own children that they're trying to you know, educate or get through college or pay for weddings and this, that, and the other. But they also have parents maybe that were not diligent in saving, or maybe their parents just fell on tough times and they're having to support aging parents and also trying to raise their own family. So planning for your own retirement can certainly be a good way to give back to your family. The parable of the 10 talents, that's come from Matthew 25. A talent, I looked it up, and I'd always heard it was a large sum of money, but one talent was worth, I think, 20 years worth of wages. So the parable is basically, you know, a master goes away and he leaves, you know, 10 talents for one of his servants and 5 talents for another, and then 1 talent for the third and the first two. And he goes away on a journey for a long trip, and he comes back at an appointed time, and the first two servants basically returned the money that they were given to steward over, and basically doubled their investment. They made 100% return, and they were told, you all heard the saying, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a little. You know, now we'll give you much." And the third servant, though, did nothing and buried it in the backyard. Basically, put it in the ground and earned no interest, and was scolded for being wicked and lazy. So certainly, I think there's a good takeaway there about being prudent and being disciplined and diligent, not being so complacent and so conservative, not wanting to take any risk. There's a fine line between being too risky and too aggressive, and maybe not taking enough risk. We'll talk a little bit about that too. faithfulness with what we've been given matters more than the amount. We've all been blessed with various talents and resources, some maybe more than others, but at the end of the day, we want to be good stewards of what we have been given, to bless those around us. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the different ways you can save and invest. Again, for many in the room, if you work for a private or public employer, whether it's the university or you work for yourself, there may be various options available, but a 401k is one of the most popular ways to save. It's generally offered by your employer. Not every company offers them, but most of them do. I think 401ks came out in the late 70s, early 80s, but it often includes a company match, so the company will encourage employee morale as a benefit. They will say, "Hey, if you put in a dollar, I'll put in a dollar for you." And it's generally capped at a certain percentage of your income. Oftentimes you'll see a a matching contribution of maybe 3 or 4%. So if you put in 3% of your income, your employer will match you dollar for dollar up to 3 or 4% of your income. So essentially you're doubling your money right out of the chute. So that's one of the first things you want to do if you are saving for retirement is make sure that you're taking advantage of what your employer is offering. And then also try to make sure you're putting in as much as you need to get that maximum employer match. Generally, the contributions are tax deductible, so you get a little bit of a tax break today. If you put in a couple thousand dollars, then when you're doing your taxes at the end of the year, your income, you're paying tax on whatever your income is minus that couple thousand dollar contribution. The money will grow without tax, and then at retirement, when you take the money out, is when you typically will pay tax. Some employers offer a Roth 401k. A Roth is just an after-tax contribution that allows your money to grow in the same manner without tax, but then in retirement, you get the money out tax-free. So you're forgoing the tax deduction today for a traditional 401k, whereas a Roth 401k, you get the tax benefit on the back end. If your employer doesn't offer, or maybe you're self-employed and you want to know how to tax efficiently save for retirement, then a traditional IRA will often make sense. You can put in up to $7,500 per year and receive a tax deduction for that. There are some caveats and rules. If you have a spouse that's working and they're covered by a retirement plan, there are some income phase outs, but generally speaking, you can contribute up to $7,500 and receive a tax deduction for that, and that's per spouse. So a husband and wife did not have a retirement plan through any of their employers, they could put in up to $15,000, $7,500 per person. If you're over age 50, the IRS allows for a what they call a catch-up provision where you can put in $8,600 if you're 50 or older. But a traditional IRA works essentially the same way as a 401k does. Tax deductible contributions, tax deferred growth, and then taxable in retirement. I did put on here at the bottom, you can do what's called a QCD, a qualified charitable distribution at age 70 and a half. Since we're in a capital campaign right now, for those who are over age 70 and a half, oftentimes you've accumulated money in your retirement plan. One of the most tax efficient ways to support Christ Pres or any charity, if you do charitable giving outside of the church, is to do what's called a QCD or qualified charitable distribution. That allows you to basically take some of your money that's in your retirement account, and the limits are pretty generous. I think it's $106,000 this year, where you can donate up to that amount, have it come out of your IRA without any tax implications, and it can go to your church or charity. Essentially you've eliminated the IRS because again, you've gotten all that money of tax deferred growth. Normally if you take it out and then you want to give away some of it, you got to take it out, you got to pay tax on it, and then what's left over you can give. But if you do a direct distribution from your IRA to Christ Pres, I use my mom as an example. She does her monthly tithing. Instead of writing the check out of her checkbook every month, we simply send her money from her IRA, and it's payable to First Presbyterian Church in Prattville, Alabama. It's mailed to her. She prefers the physical act of putting the check in the offering plate, which is fine. You can also just have it mailed directly to the church. But that way, she doesn't have to take money out of her checking account every month. It just simply comes out of her retirement account, and it's a little bit easier sometimes to do it that way. A lot of times people don't feel it or see it as much when it's not hitting their checkbook, and it's maybe coming out of an account that oftentimes is much larger than you would have in your checking account. So that's something to consider. You can't do that out of a 401k. The money has to go from a 401k to an IRA first, but for those who are 70 and a half or older, that's certainly a good little tool to take advantage of. And at 73, you have to start taking what's called a required minimum distribution. So all these years of tax deferral, some people plan well and save well and they have other sources of income and they say, I don't really need this money. I don't want to take the money out because I got to pay tax on it. Well, at age 73, you've got to start taking what's called an RMD, or required minimum distribution. So oftentimes people will just take that RMD and say, I don't need it. I'm just going to donate my RMD to the church or to another qualified charity. And then a Roth IRA, I think I touched on that a little bit, but you don't get the tax deduction today. You get the tax benefits on the back end when you take it out in retirement. The one rule is that it has to be in place for at least 5 years. You have to be 59 and a half or older to be able to access the tax-free distributions. And there are income limits on that as well. If you if you're single and you make over $153,000, you're considered, I guess, too wealthy or have too high of an income to contribute to a Roth IRA, and the IRS will not let you make a contribution. It does phase out at about $168,000. If you're a married couple, it's $242,000 of income up to about, I think, $252,000. So if you make, you know, $1 million a year, you're not able to make a Roth contribution. There are some backdoor caveats to that where you can potentially still make a contribution, but that's a little beyond the scope of this conversation. Another proverb comes from chapter 21, verse 5. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. I think this is just talking to the importance of being patient. Disciplined planning trumps impatient, impulsive action. Saving steadily, avoiding unnecessary debt, and investing patiently is certainly a good axiom to remember. Some of the biggest mistakes I've seen people make are get rich quick type schemes. We've all heard of people that have maybe invested in Ponzi schemes or things that sound too good to be true. Well, oftentimes that is just exactly the case. Your money doesn't, when it's invested, it doesn't grow, it doesn't double overnight. If somebody is proposing that they can double your money, over the next year, there's either probably extreme risk or they're a wolf in disguise as sheepskin's clothing. Another one of my favorite verses is from Ecclesiastes. One of my favorite books of the Bible. Is just so much good financial wisdom there. But this says, cast your bread on the waters, for there you will find it after many days. Divide your portions to seven or eight, or even to eight, for you don't know what disaster may happen on earth. So, Solomon was the author of Ecclesiastes, and back in those days, merchants and sailors would probably, put their grain or bread on the water. They would, engage in trade and send it off to other parts of areas around the world, wherever they were living, and then they hope to, over time, maybe get something back in return in exchange for that. And I think the same thing is true today. When you put your money into a 401k or a retirement plan, you're not going to get it back probably after a few days. In fact, if you're thinking that way, you're not thinking the right way. You need to look at this through the lens of a 20, 30, 40-year investment horizon, but many years from now, more than likely, it'll come back to you with interest and lots of friends that you've earned, those dollars have made along the way. Giving portions to seven or eight, I think that just talks about diversification and not putting all your eggs in one basket. So for every 25-year-old or wherever that age range may be, I think one of the key takeaways would be to start earlier. Time is your greatest asset. It's again that compound interest calculation we did earlier. It's not as much about how much you save, but it's how many years those savings can be working for you. If you're still relatively young, you're probably not behind. But the important thing is to start today. For the 55-year-old, again, diversification is important. It's one of the most important things you can do, again, in terms of just making sure that you're not taking too much risk and having all your eggs in one basket. But you also have to think long-term as well. Even, a 55-year-old has different goals from a 25-year-old, and they may be thinking, well, I don't have, 30, 40 years for my money to grow and accumulate. I'm going to retire at 65 or some other age. You still have to think long-term. Many have probably heard your 60s are kind of your go-go years where you're very active and maybe traveling and doing quite a few things. And maybe your 70s and 80s become your slow-go years. You're still active, but maybe not as active as you once were. And then eventually you get into your no-go years where you're probably not doing as much as you were earlier on, but you still have to think with that long-term mindset. Things like inflation, which are referred to as a silent or stealth tax, can really ravage your dollars over time. So some of your money probably should still be working with a long-term view in mind, even for someone who's 65 that may live. I think the studies show that a married couple age 65 or older, there's a, I think it's a greater than 50% chance that one of those spouses will live to be 95. So you do have to think long-term, even if you're already retired and already at age 60 or 65. So when investing, again, this is, I stole this from JP Morgan. The stock market can be very volatile. It's a good place, again, for long-term wealth. It's probably not the place you're going to put your money for buying your next vehicle, because there's a chance that it could go down in the short term. But this just shows the various peaks and valleys going back to 1980. The gray bars are the calendar year returns, how much the stock market increased or decreased over that calendar year. And you can see there have been some really good returns in the 20s, even some returns in the 30s. Going back to 1980, but there's a couple gray bars below that x-axis, and there have been some negatives. 2008 was the one that most people probably remember if you're old enough. Stock market dropped 38% that year, and at its highest point to its lowest point, it fell 59%. So, you know, it's not often that happens, but that's probably a once-a-generation type thing. But you know, again, you need to have savings for those emergency funds and opportunities. But for longer term growth purposes, like IRAs, 401ks, the stock market can be a great place to grow and accumulate assets over time. Psalm 24:1 says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." Obviously, everything belongs to God. We're just stewards. We're managers of what we have. Every dollar, no matter how many commas are on your financial statement or in your bank account or your 401k, God owns it all. It's just we're asked to be stewards of that. And then one day your future self will thank your present you. So that's really kind of the gist. There were a couple of questions that were put into the material that I was asked to talk on, but we can open this up for discussion and certainly do any Q&A that anybody may have, but has anybody ever run the math on their retirement savings in terms of how much you need to accumulate? Anybody ever done that calculation to think about, you know, what it would cost for them to retire? Anybody ever looked at that? There was a commercial a few years ago, or maybe it's been a decade or so. I think it was ING that became Voya, but there was some guy walking around with a number, like a seven-figure number, you know, 1-point-something million. Another guy had a 2-point-something million, but basically they were touting, hey, let us help you figure out what that number is. And it is oftentimes a big number. It can be daunting, but I think I've read recently that Fidelity estimates that the average 65-year-old will spend, I think it's close to $180,000 just in healthcare costs. So it'd be things like Medicare, prescriptions, you know, doctor's visits. That's per person. So if you're married, that's probably more like $350,000-$360,000 just for Medicare. I mean, just for healthcare that include groceries and vacations and spoiling the grandkids and all the other things that go along with that. The second question is more, what would it mean to plan for the future as an act of love for your family rather than an act of anxiety? Again, I think that just more is, you know, the more you plan and prepare today, the better off your family, your loved ones, your church. If you are a good steward and you have planned accordingly, then it can really be a blessing to others in retirement. Later on, in terms of being able to take care of those nearest you. And then the third question is more is, how is retirement planned in an act of generosity? I think that kind of ties into the second question, but any thoughts or feedback or questions on any of that, or has anybody in the room learned something from their parents, grandparents, that has been helpful to them in terms of perspective and how that's helped them financially long-term in terms of saving for retirement?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Nowhere in the Bible does it talk about, you know, being retired. In fact, if you, one of the definitions for retirement in Webster's dictionary is to be taken out of use. So if you think about it from that standpoint, I don't think any of us like the thought of being taken out of use. I think it's often more of a, what are you retiring from? And then what are you retiring to? So maybe you're retiring from a specific occupation and maybe you have saved well enough to where you don't necessarily have to work every day. I think there's a big difference working because you like to work and working because you have to work. You know, I don't have a ton of hobbies, so I don't really have a this date where I can't wait to retire. I like my job, I like what I do, so I've got flexibility, so I don't really, for me, think that I've got a date where I'm gonna be out of the workforce. I just think I'm not wired that way. But other people have very demanding jobs, certainly people that have physical jobs, you know, whether it's, you know, construction related or something that does require a lot of physical demands of their body. I think that would be one form of retirement that's just good to kind of transition into something else. But yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think just in general, the pervasive wealth that the U.S. has, it's probably more common here than maybe many other parts of the world. But I think, you know, being able to still be active and useful in retirement, whether that's serving more, you know, in your church family or in the community, maybe it's mission trips, maybe it's just helping out with other things. I mean, we have so many different ministries here in the church that you could certainly retire from your job, but still have a purpose and sense of doing something helpful. So, good question, though. I don't know if I have a great answer for that. Yeah, anybody else have other good podcasts or books that they've read on financial stewardship or other topics that may be worth sharing? I know next week Errol is teaching on the concept of enough and the discipline of contentment and things like lifestyle creep and defining enough and doing subscription audits and things of that nature. So that should be interesting. But yeah, I think that's, I did also wrote down, didn't make the slide deck, but another verse that I've really enjoyed and tried to reflect on is from Ecclesiastes 5:19. It says, "Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions, the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift from God." I've seen a lot of people that have a lot of money that are miserable. They're scared of losing it. They just obsess over it. They can enjoy it. And it sounds kind of counterintuitive. How can you be so wealthy and not be, you know, content? But Brian? Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, you try to plan for all the contingencies and I think, I can't remember who said it, but something to the effect of, you know, when you've done all your planning, you know, risk is, you know, is basically everything else. That, you know, everything that you thought you planned for, there's always still that one risk that's lurking that you can't ever completely plan away. So there is that mentality of wanting to, you know, like John Rockefeller when asked, you know, how much more money do you need? And he said, just a little more, you know, like there's often that mentality of, is there really enough? Like, what is my number and when can you walk away? So I think that is something that it's a hard issue, you know, where your treasure is, there your heart will be, you know, and if you're holding onto those things too tightly and, it becomes an angst of worry, then there's certainly some hard issues there, I think. But, you know, but you want to, I mean, I've seen other extremes where people just, you know, are so generous and they want to help out every family member and support every charitable endeavor. And they're just not planning. It's not common that happens, but sometimes they're like, hey, God will take care of me. And a lot of times that is the case, but I think you do need to have a healthy balance between the two and not just assume that, you know, that things will always, you know, your kids will be there to bail you out or that you know, God gave you a brain to plan for emergencies, like John talked about last week, and to have an emergency fund set aside for the uncertain things. But yeah, it's a good question. It's one that I think we should all think about, because again, the different levels of savings and wealth are vast, and I think people often will struggle with that. How much is enough, and when should I start maybe giving away more, and as opposed to just leaving, you know, millions of dollars to your kids one day. I think it's Warren Buffett who supposedly is only, you know, the man's, I think one of the, I don't think he's the wealthiest person anymore. I think Elon Musk surpassed him recently. But I think he's only leaving, I think, $10 million to his kids. And he's worth, I don't know, however many hundreds of billions, which again, $10 million is a lot of money. But he just wants to make sure they're taken care of, but not have so much money that it creates all sorts of other issues and problems. So, any other questions or comments? Yeah, that's a good question too. I mean, it does vary just depending on people's lifestyle and their expenses. And some people can maybe live very comfortably on a couple $1,000s a month, and other people, depending on maybe the lifestyle they've become accustomed to, might be substantially more than that. So yeah, I would say it's very individualized and very specific. You know, I'm trying to think. There's studies out there that show, you know, what percentage of your, like a multiple of your income you should have by certain ages. Again, it's hard to say, just because, you know, some people have lived very conservatively, they've saved very aggressively, so they're used to living below their means, whereas other people might just save the bare minimum, and they might find that that's not sufficient enough to really meet their needs in retirement. So. But I think your point about you know, categories, you've got your discretionary, your non-discretionary expenses, things that you have to pay for, whether it's, you know, food, shelter, housing, you know, things like health insurance and car insurance and fuel and all the things that we have to pay for, food. That's kind of one category. Those are kind of your non-negotiables, and you know, kind of rule of thumb will be in retirement. At minimum, you want to have those needs covered through guaranteed income sources. So things like Social Security can help meet that to the extent that you're comfortable assuming that will be there. I read the other day that I think in 2032, only 78% of Social Security payments will be able to be met. The surplus that's available in the trust fund today will be depleted by 2032. Doesn't mean that Social Security is going away, but they're going to have to raise taxes or do some sort of means testing, but if your non-discretionary expenses can be met through guaranteed income sources, then at least you know that those things are covered. So whether it's having money set aside to cover those things, but then all your other discretionary expenses, travel, you know, leisure, lifestyle, you know, maybe it's Ole Miss football tickets, those other things that are nice to have but you don't have to have, and that's typically where your things like your IRAs, your 401ks, your long-term savings can help kind of supplement that. So it's a good question. I mean, if you're looking at just for percentages in terms of what to save, the average American, I think, saves like 3%, but I don't think anybody wants to be average. Again, you put in 3% to your 401k, you get your company match. A lot of people say, hey, I'm saving. And that's a good start. But yeah, I think at minimum, people should try to, you know, give 10, at minimum, save 10. You know, government's gonna get a chunk of that in the form of taxes, depending on your tax bracket. And then whatever's left over, you know, is there to cover your discretionary and non-discretionary expenses, so. All right, it's 10:30. I don't wanna keep any kids from getting in here, and I know we've got some kids outside the door, but anyway, if anybody has questions, feel free to find me. Happy to chat further, and make sure to come back next week for Errol's topic on enough.